Comrades, this is your captain. It is an honor to speak to you today, and I'm honored to be sailing with you on the maiden voyage of our motherland's most recent achievement.
Doctor, this is a combat vessel of the Soviet Navy.
Welcome to the show. This is Evan Marshall, and you're on the Soul Kitchen. I started tonight's show with a clip from Red October because I wanted to emphasize the revolutionary spirit here at BBS Talk Radio. But also because I believe that we are truly in the midst of a revolution of sorts. It's a revolution of technology, ideas, and information. We've entered a period in history unlike any other. The leaps in knowledge and technology today is unprecedented. If you were to look at technological advancement since the dawn of man in strictly linear terms, things progressed at a fairly steady pace over time, from the invention of the wheel, simple tools, conveniences, etc., to man's limited understanding of science and medicine right up until the Industrial Revolution at the turn of the last century. The cumulative effect of all of the knowledge gained up until that point in history coalesced and took off. The progression up to that point was somewhat slow and plodding. We then entered a period of quantum leaps in all areas and have now progressed into hyperspace. The amount of progress in the past 100 years is astonishing. Look at the advancements in science and technology since the turn of the last century. We've gone from the Wright brothers and Kitty Hawk to landing on the moon. Look at the advancements in medicine and other sciences, the decoding of DNA, the splitting of the atom, the list goes on. Well, what these quantum leaps in technology have done for media as well is remarkable. It wasn't all that long ago that people gathered around the radio as their primary source for news and entertainment. I can still remember when there were only three stations on TV. Color television wasn't broadcast widely until the mid-60s. FM radio didn't take off until the 70s. We now have 24-hour programming, over 100 channels of satellite TV, satellite radio. I remember buying 45s and 8-track tapes. Your entire CD collection is now obsolete. All of the traditional forms of media are falling by the wayside, and the rules have changed. In fact, no one really knows what the rules are anymore. Network television has lost its influence and market share. Print media is declining. Newspaper distribution keeps shrinking. And less people are watching traditional evening news. The major media outlets and every market are scrambling to embrace the new technologies and adapt. The problem is the technologies are changing so fast that each time they try, the game changes again. New markets and demographics have emerged. Entire industries have evolved where there were none previously. And think about this. There is more computing power in an iPhone than there was in the lunar module. So what's next? Look back just 10 years ago and see how much has changed. Where are we going to be 20 years from now? We're no longer subject to the selective spoon-feeding we've been receiving, whether it be news, entertainment, music, history, or information in all forms. We're now in the driver's seat, and we're no longer at the mercy of program directors, station managers, advertising executives, Nielsen and Arbitron ratings, or any other entity. The advent of YouTube, internet radio, streaming media, just to name a few, all of these are outlets of information and entertainment have made it possible to get your message out and bypass all traditional forms of distribution. And we're seeing it in all areas today. Anyone with a camera can be a producer, director, or actor. Anyone with a microphone and computer can make a record and distribute their music or spoken word. And anyone can publish and distribute their own thoughts, ideas, and observations through blogs or electronic newsletters. And everyone can be famous now for 15 minutes. That doesn't necessarily mean that anyone is going to buy these products or read the blogs or tune into the music or anything else. And while there's infinitely more choices available than ever before, it also means there's an awful lot of crap and misinformation out there. But that's not really the point. Market will ultimately decide based on demand. That's the free market. That's democracy. The fact that these choices are available to us at all means freedom in and of itself. And it's the freedom to choose. Freedom to seek and gain knowledge. To choose the forms of entertainment and news that each of us want. The freedom to tune out those things we choose not to hear, to tailor our individual tastes and desires, and the freedom to communicate thoughts and ideas worldwide. This is an awesome power, unprecedented in history. How we choose to embrace this freedom and use it will most certainly determine our future. We are definitely in the midst of a revolution. Seek the truth and you shall find it.
Thank you.
right, you're on the Soul Kitchen with Evan Marshall here on bbstalkradio.com, and we've got a very special guest for you tonight. Alan Graham is here in the studio. Alan was Jim Morrison's brother-in-law, was married to Jim's sister Ann for 22 years, and knew Jim very, very well. He spent a lot of time with him, and he's just come out with a new book called I Remember, about his remembrances of Jim and the Morrison family. And we're going to be talking to him about the book and answering your calls a little bit later. And right now, I'd like to welcome Alan to the program. Alan, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you, Evan. Thank you for letting me be your first guest. And can I say something about your rap there?
Please.
When I met Jim's sister in 1966 in London, there was a phenomenon occurring called pirate radio. And it was great because it wasn't the old staid BBC. You know, it was rock and roll, and it was on a ship. A guy was out in off the three-mile limit in England, and that was exciting. That was a turn of it for radio, and it's like, we're the new pirates.
I'd like to talk to you about that. I want to know some of the background. I'm very visual, and so I'd like you to, if you can, kind of fill in the picture for us. You mentioned that when you were in London and you met Jim's sister. I wonder if you can kind of fill in the rest of the blanks. You know, give us an idea of what it was like and how you met Anne and all of that.
Well, you got to remember at that time in London, it was like people had gone out of their minds in the greatest way. People were wearing like loud colors. A few months earlier, they were all wearing dull and gray. The whole world seemed to go nuts. Everyone was dropping LSD. It was like a new paradise. There were no restrictions. You didn't have, you know, one husband and one wife. All of that stuff was thrown up in the air. So when I met Jim's sister, I had like a bunch of girlfriends. And she said to me, you've got all these girlfriends here, you see, and that won't fly with us. And I said, well, you can come with us. We all go on dates. And that's the way it was. I'm not joking here. And so one morning she said to me, this is what we're going to do. You're going to give up all those girlfriends, and it's going to be just you and I. And I said, do you think for one minute that I'm going to give up everything for you? And she said, yes, and I did. So that was all I knew, that she was just another American girl, and her father was in the military. And
what was she doing in London?
Well, like everyone, she came there to finish her studies. Her parents were in the Navy in London, for example. He was stationed at the Navy building in London. So she came with her family, and instead of not going to school, she continued it on an American base, you know, Navy Air Base.
Now, at the time that you met Anne, the doors hadn't hit big yet. And so at that time, she really didn't know what Jim was doing. Is that right?
All she told me was, I have an older brother who disappeared a couple of years ago. He graduated from UCLA, and his dad was angry with him because he wouldn't register with the draft, and he was going to throw all his career up for Hollywood when he could have been anything he wanted. He was what they call a gifted student, and when you get gifted student status, all the headhunters from the CIA and all the major corporations, they're going to hire that kid. Morrison just couldn't care less. His dad did not like that, so Morrison disappeared. So when I met Anne and we got married, the parents were called back to the United States. The admiral was going to be stationed at the Pentagon. So they went back, and a few months later, we got an album in the mail. The first Doors album, Anna opened it up, and it was Jim's face, and she burst into tears. And that's the first time we found out that he was famous. He'd been lost until that moment. And a year later, we came to the United States, and when we got here, Light My Fire was number one in the nation.
Now, when you got the album, had you been listening to him on the radio?
Never heard a word about it. No, because he wasn't yet to England. When he did get there, people said, oh, the American Rolling Stones, because that's, you know, his rhythm and blues, and it sounded like them. But we didn't know. When we heard his stuff and we looked who wrote it, Weil, Breck, all of the blues people, this was not rubbish music. This was top of the line, and people just knocked out by it. So when we saw it was him, we were just, God, just blew our minds.
Now, Jim's dad was an admiral in the Navy. At the time that you were over in London, was he the admiral on the Bonhomme Richard during that time, or was that previous?
He was stationed. He had just made admiral. He was stationed in London. I forget what duty he was on, but he was then sent back to the Pentagon, where he waited about a year, and then he went. He took Carrier Division 9 out of Sasebo and went out to fight the Vietnamese War. And he would come back and forth, you know, like he'd do 2 years out there and then he'd come back. And when we arrived, he'd just been given orders to go to California. So I arrived in Washington, D.C., Arlington, Virginia. 6 weeks later, we were told, we're going to California. And I knew then that we were going to go find Jim as soon as we got there, and that's exactly what we did. We landed at the airport, we put our bags with their longtime friend Andy Richards, and we drove to Los Angeles. And on the way, I stopped at a phone booth and I dialed 411 and said, could you give me a number for Elektra Records? And they said, yes. And I called Elektra Records and I said, could you give me a number for the Doors office? And they said, yes. And I called the Doors office and I said, hello, this is Al Graham, I'm Jim's brother-in-law. And that was a long silence, like a joke. I said, his sister and I, and another long silence, we just come in we want to meet him. After a while, she said, well, okay, he's coming in from he's coming from Houston. So we drove to the airport, and we waited, and the flight emptied, no Morrison, nothing. Finally, he saunters off the plane wearing a World War II bomber jacket, an original one, big sou'wester, big fur. Carrying a cool-looking but beat-the-hell-up briefcase with all his writings in it, and the Doors were following behind him languidly, slowly. So Anna walks up to Jim and says, hi. And he looked at her like, he thought it was a fan, or worse, that this was a girl he'd had a liaison with, and this was because she was offering him a baby.
And how long had it been since she had seen
3 years.
And she hadn't had any contact with him at all.
In fact, we walked up alongside him, and he looked over at me first. She was carrying a baby, and he looked at her and looked away, and she said, hi, Jim, and he went. He didn't know what to do. He was flummoxed. And so he said to her, you wouldn't happen to be my sister, would you? Just like that. And she said, yes, and this is your nephew, Dylan. And this is my husband, Alan. We're from England. And he looked at us for a long time. And then all of a sudden, he just grabbed my son, put him on his hip, and said, come on, I want you to meet everybody, and walked out of the airport.
See, now that's the kind of story that nobody's ever heard before. And it you know, I was really anticipating reading your book, because this is the kind of background information about Jim that no one's ever heard before. And it really kind of rounds out the whole picture of him as a person.
Well, the reason for that, and the 40 books have been written, and you only ever get the 5 years, the radical Jim Morrison, and the family never has spoken properly and probably never will. So you'll never get that information. And the only information you'll have is what I tell, because they're just almost reclusive. They don't see any value in talking about this anymore in the public. So for them, it's, you know. So that you'll always get this limited picture of what Jim Morrison was. And so everyone who writes a book, they just take what someone else wrote and now they put in their own little thing. One guy wrote this book, I can't remember his name, but it was all about Jim Morrison being gay and all about these 12 affairs he had with 12 men. And it was like such crap, but it sold. And all the other books sold. And the public doesn't know the real story until right now. What you have is the Saturday morning cartoon version of Jim's life.
Well, and that's just it, you know. That's why I was so interested to talk to you, because nobody's ever heard anything other than what you said, the kind of one-dimensional, hell-bent rock and roller, and nobody's one-dimensional.
Well, you know why? A lot of this happened deliberately by Jim, because no one knew that he was once Clark Kent, a fat little middle-class kid who's over 8, actually. He was a plump little bastard. We Andy Morrison and me were looking at a photo of him, Mary Werbelow, and Andy. And Andy looked at him and said, he was a fat bastard, wasn't he? And he had a plump belly and he was a well-nourished kid, you know what I mean? But you won't get any more information about Jim Morrison from the Doors, because they only knew him what he told them he was. So he was Clark Kent, but when he came to them, oh no, he was the Lizard King. He made it up. He made who he was. And they didn't. He became the personification of the Doors because he did not want to be Clark Kent anymore. He wanted to run the hell away from that regimen and get into his own world, and he did.
Well, the thing that I think most Doors fans are really going to appreciate about your book, and like I say, it really exceeded my expectations because it kind of rounds out the whole story and you get an entirely different view of how he was as a... here's a guy who had a sister and a brother, and we haven't heard much about their relationship. And
yeah, they're very private people. They'll never... Andy, just if you talk to Andy about his brother, he'll just look at you like drywall, paint drying, because unless he wants to and he's in a good mood. But it's like for them, it's redundant, and they've seen so much. For example, Manzarek and Krieger went on Coast to Coast Radio the night, and they made a mockery of the Doors, of themselves, and of Jim Morrison's memory. And they discussed personal details of Jim's family, for example, what happened with the grave and what happened with the machine. And Ray was very disrespectful, I thought, and so was Robbie, to Pamela and to the Morrisons, because they said this like, oh, Jim probably had lots of kids, and Ray came on with this fake accent saying, but he squirted a lot of girls around. It was like, really, man, if you're going to represent the Doors, you know, like, do it uptown. And they don't, I'm sorry to say. Krieger plays a beautiful guitar. He's a good technician. And Manzarek's a good technician, but he should shut up. I don't mean that in a good way.
Getting back to the book, and since you mentioned Coast to Coast, are you going to have an appearance coming up here shortly on Coast to Coast?
At the end of the month. And I want to talk about that, for example. We had a Coast to Coast date. In fact, I was the one who set the Coast to Coast date up. It was going to be me and the Doors. And Krieger made it, and then Manzarek wasn't sure. So I emailed Manzarek and said, hey, you should be there. And he said, okay, he's going to be there. And turns out that Jeff Jampol, the manager of the Doors, I guess he got the word from Krieger. I don't know why, but we're not going to appear with Alan Graham. So we decided, okay, we'll do our own show next, you know, at the end of the month when the book comes out. But it was like a very silly rivalry, you know. We're all promoting the Doors. We all love the Doors, and we all want the Doors music to be sold every minute of the day. So I think the most positive thing you can do is talk about the music, rock and roll, of that aspect of it, and not go into the dirty details that you don't know anything about and insult the family and stuff like that. Once again, I'm done with that rap.
When is your appearance going to be on Coast to Coast?
Well, my book comes out on the 14th, and right after that, it'll probably be the next week, but I'll let you know for sure.
Great. And this information will be posted on your website?
Yes, and on Coast to Coast, too.
Okay. And how do people find your website?
Mine?
Yes.
It's www.lizardkinglounge.com or www.darkriders.com. Dark Riders, R-Y. Dark Riders with a Y. .com. That, you can see my book and Ghost Radio and all the other projects we're doing, and you go to my website, Lizard King, and see some good stories.
All right, while we're on the subject, how does one go about getting a copy of this book?
Well, if you go to that Dark Riders site, there's a PayPal up there, there's a credit card thing, you can buy it right now.
Is the book available now?
Yes, it is. Well, you can order it, and it'll be here in 2 weeks.
Great. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with Alan Graham, and we're talking some more about his book, I Remember, about his brother-in-law, Jim Morrison, and we're going to be right back.
Listening to the moon, let's climb through the tide. Penetrate the evening that the city sleeps too high. Swim out tonight, love. It's our turn to try. Park beside the ocean on our moonlight drive. Let's swim to the moon. Let's climb through the tide.
Back. You're on the Soul Kitchen, and we're back with Alan Graham. And we're not going to be taking any calls just yet. We're going to wait until a little further in the program. Alan, there was something I read in the book prior to the show, and you know, I only had a chance to leaf through it briefly, but this was just a dynamite story. Can you tell us about the Ed Sullivan appearance with Light My Fire and how that all unfolded? That's just that's a great story no one's ever heard.
Yeah. Well, when I arrived in the United States in the summer of 68, it was like there was a giant wedding. One of the Clara's nephews was getting married, and he was also being deployed overseas to Vietnam at the time. So there was a big gathering with, you know, all of the peers of the admiral, other admirals, captains, all Navy, and, you know, the Navy social set that Morrison's knew in Washington, D.C. at the time. And everyone was around the pool, swimming and eating and drinking and having fun. It was great. And toward the end of the evening, Clara looked awfully disturbed for a minute, and the two sisters had her in the kitchen going, whispering like this, and then Steve comes in and says, "What the Sam hell's going?" All of a sudden, without anybody being able to do anything about it, the televisions all over the house say, "Hey, look at this! Ed Sullivan!" Ed Sullivan comes on. "Welcome to our show, ladies and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, the Topol Gijo." All the silliest acts. And then a giant lady, Kate Smith, who sang "God Bless America" to blew the enamel off your teeth. I mean, forceful, you know. It was like family acts, you know, the Ed Sullivan Show. Then out of nowhere, someone says, "Hey, this is a rerun." And oh, my God, it dawned on Clara and everyone else that, oh, I knew nothing about it. And most of those people in that audience, in that crowd, knew nothing what was going to happen next. What happened next was Ed Sullivan said, "Ladies and gentlemen, from Los Angeles, California, The Doors." And everyone in that place who knew Jim Morrison as a teenager, who knew him as Clark Kent, absolutely the most polite man to old ladies, and a grown-up boy, articulate, totally intelligent, oh, the most marvelous example of rigid Navy compliance. And all of a sudden, there he was with long, looked like a biker, leather coat, leather pants, angry, pissed off at the world, singing "Light My Fire." And one of the uncles, well, they're all, you got to understand, all these people are like rigid Navy, and they're looking at this like, one lady is holding a champagne bottle, pouring it into a glass, frozen stiff, looking at this image of Morrison singing "Light My Fire." And everyone knew that was that Jim Morrison. The admiral was looking aghast, and all the other admirals were like, ah. And so this poor woman looked like she was in a fountain with bubbly champagne all over the counter and everything. And what everyone who knows that Ed Sullivan said, "You must not say, cannot get any higher. Remember the Rolling Stones had come spend the night with me?" So Morrison, when it got to that point, Morrison went, he said it, but he said it with anger. You could tell it was like, "You don't tell me what to." And that broke the mold. We knew that that was the rebel, and all these people were watching it. And there's the rebel of rock and roll, that Satan, the motorcycle god, was singing to these people. And they were all, finally, after the show ended, it was a complete silence. And one of the old admirals, who to me resembled Lee J. Cobb, the actor, Townsend was his name, I think. No, it was someone else. Anyway, he just looked at the screen for a long time, and then he closed his eyes and just started going. And everybody started laughing. It was kind of like a relief. And then it was like, God almighty, that was my first weekend in the United States.
So his family knew what he was doing. They were just...
They didn't until that year.
No, but I mean, they weren't... They were trying to keep it under wraps as much as they could.
If the admiral sat in the Pentagon one morning, this is how he found out. And his secretary looked at him at the door like kind of funny, and he said, "What's wrong with her?" So he went to lunch, and he came back, and she was looking at him funny again. Like, he kept looking in the mirror to see what's wrong with her. "I've got something on me." And she kept looking at the door, like, and then she'd look at his desk. He'd go, "What the?" And he finally looked down at the desk where she was looking at. Time magazine was laying there on his desk. Jim Morrison, famous. Yes, he does have talent. Yes, he made it. Yes, he made it overnight. Yes, it's a miracle. Yes, it's your son. I understand the admiral just... Well, can you imagine?
Yeah, I can. Was the rest of the family musical? Andy or Anne, the admiral, Clara?
Morrison's family. Clara, Admiral Morrison's mother was a pianist in a silent movie theater. She played beautifully. Alan, one of the cousins of the Morrisons, had perfect pitch. He couldn't hear music unless it was perfect. Must have been agonizing for him. Admiral played the most beautiful piano his mother taught him. He'd never heard. And he sang with a voice just as good or better than his son. And Anna plays beautiful piano. Andy plays a ukulele. And all of those Morrisons, and people think Morrison didn't sing, he grew up around a piano from a little kid, because we carried on the tradition when I came to America. Sundays, a family would gather around in a friend's house called Bob McDermott, a long-time Navy friend, and he would record everything, and he still has all these recordings of Jim singing, "You've got a line, I got a pole, hey, Dad." And we've got audio of when I came here, of the Admiral saying, "Okay, Alan, you're going to sing tenor? Yeah, okay, what's the song? Annie Laurie? Okay, Alan, I'll back." You could hear this beautiful little family thing. Morrison grew up, he knew the music. He couldn't write it, he couldn't play an instrument, but it was in his head. And one day, I came to Elektra Studios to see him, and it was like he was in there with Robbie Krieg, and this is how I discovered how it worked. The door opened, and Jim was sitting on a big hippie cushion, tie-dye cushion. Robbie Krieger was next to him, and Jim was saying to him, "No, no, no, no." It goes like this, da 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 da, and Robbie would go do do do. So you see, the music was in Jim's head, and he imparted that to them with most of the melodies. You can hear a couple of Robbie's songs. You can hear "Running Blue." That's Robbie's. It's light, except for the part Jim put on the front of it. You can hear Robbie's wonderful guitar work on Spanish Caravan, except that is not Robbie's piece. That's a piece by Isaac Albéniz. It's called Suite Astorius, and it's Cantos de España. But for a long time, people thought that was Robbie's brilliance, but that was not true.
One of the other stories that I read in the book, is you said, since you mentioned Elektra, was a time that you went to Elektra and they were recording Roadhouse Blues.
Yeah, that was great. That was.
And Jim says hi to Dylan.
Yeah, we came to this this is the wonderful thing about the '60s. We just throw a turkey in the car on Thanksgiving, cooked, and we drive up. Andy, me, Anna, Dylan. And we just drive up to see Jim in Hollywood. We do that. It was wonderful. Those things. One day we drove up. It was a beautiful summer day. We went to the Dawes office. He said, "He's over at Elektra." This is how loose it was. There was no, you couldn't get in. It was like everything was open. You could see the Doors practicing in their office if you walked by on the street. So we go in the studio, and Anna's carrying Dylan on her arm, and I'm standing next to her. And they send us into the sound booth. And Jim's in, they send us into the control booth, and Jim's in the sound booth, and he looks up when he's practicing rock, Roadhouse Blues. And he goes right into this cool rap. He doesn't say, "Hey, hi guys, how you doing?" He goes, "You're going to have to play the piece."
I've got it. Okay, I've got the clip.
Let's hear it. It's so cool because he's talking to my son, and he's like, he fits it into the song. You got to hear it. It's too cool for me to F up.
Here it is.
Yeah. Oh, me and my baby walking down the street. We's being friendly to every person we meet, you know that. Yeah, say hi, neighbor. How you doing? Hey, Dylan, how you doing, babe? Where you going, boy? What's happening out there? Right. Ooh, lot of love, baby. I got a whole lot of love, baby.
That was cool, man.
Is that the clip you were talking about?
Yeah, let me finish the story. We went in the studio and we were standing there watching him. It was like, oh my God, he's putting us on tape. Of course, I maybe didn't think it like that at the time, but it was just a thrill to be interacting, and that Jim was, you know, no one else would have done that. You wouldn't be allowed to get in the studio, and it would be like so business-like, right? So for years and years and years, I said, I got to find that. But I never could. And then couple of years ago, I asked Anna, would you take a look in the archives? And she looked and looked and looked. We couldn't find that thing anywhere. And I said, oh, it's probably been thrown out. Turns out it was already released on...
Perception.
Perception, right. It was one of the outtakes. And it was like, oh, my God, we found it. It took me right back in time to the day we were... And it's like, what a thrill, man. Yeah. My son is in Roadhouse, and it's great. And Dylan, you know, it's like...
How old was Dylan at that time?
He was 8 months.
Oh, he's just a baby.
Yeah.
Okay. By the way, I was at the ceremony where they got their star on the Walk of Fame.
Yeah.
And Dylan represented the Morrison family.
Yeah,
and,
very proud of him. He looks just like his brother. I mean, his uncle.
His uncle, yeah. Yeah, you must be proud of him. He's a great representative of the family.
Oh, yeah, he's a cool kid.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, before we just took that break, we were talking about, you know, you were mentioning how the family was somewhat musical, and I had read that Jim was a big fan of Sinatra and Elvis.
I considered Morrison a crooner. He had a great crooner voice. And
there's a great story in the liner notes on Strange Days from Bruce Botnick, and Bruce was saying that... when they were recording Strange Days, he got a Telefunken U-47 microphone. That's the microphone that hangs down from the ceiling. And got it ready for Jim. And that when Jim saw it, he understood the significance because you know, Sinatra used the same mic on the Swingin' Sessions. Yeah. In fact, it's right on the cover of the album.
Yeah.
And so he really thought that was kind of cool.
I'm going to tell you about a mic. Do you know that famous mic you see Morrison holding that long? That was he was the first one to grab that baby, and he ordered it from Germany, and he got it on his birthday, and he went into his studios in West LA, Gordy Hall Mel's studio on the corner of Butler and Santa Monica, and he had the engineer lock him in there for hours and hours, and he sat there. I didn't ever find what he did, but it's probably in all of that mix. But he just, on his birthday alone, he sat there for hours. He made sure the engineer locked him in. And he just did his own thing, hours and hours and hours of it. And another time, in the middle of the night, I got a call. It was just after my daughter Tristan was born. And I left a message to tell Jim, your uncle, again. And he called back in the middle of the night. It was like 3 in the morning. Anna answered the phone. And he'd just gotten back from Miami then, and it was the fires were burning all over L.A., and he was telling me about, God, even at the beach, it's like the end of the world. That's what he was saying. He went on to tell me this story. I never got it complete, but it was like this. There was a murder in a southern mansion, and a slave was murdered. Anyway, the whole mood was kind of like morbid, and it's like, all these heavy stories I was telling him. I think it was this Miami thing that was burdening him, you know, but it was a heavy conversation. And at the end of it, he said, it feels like the end of the world. And it was all like this about him not being able to go to the beach, not being able to see the blue sky, not be able to see his LA because it was choking. In fact, Southern California was choking. It was fist deep in the gutters. And it was like, so I could feel this great sadness, you know, over him as he was talking about, but he was telling these incredibly depressing poems, that's all I can tell you. And it was like, I never heard those either, but I'd like to find them because they were so poignant, you know, like, anyway, so then Anna made me a cup of coffee and we talked all night, him and me. He talked about, and he read me his poetry with such, you know, like, you're listening to me. It's like, if he was talking to the world, he'd loved it, but for one person, if he gave you a one-on-one and he said, I'm telling you, another quick one. He would write and write and write in a book. And for some reason, if he didn't like it, he would leave it in a cafe. Or he'd just leave it on a bus stop without his name in it. You know, so you know there's tons of crap flying around out there. He probably thought, well, it's not good enough and just left it. But how artistic, you know? So people, I don't know if anything ever survived, but there's so much that we didn't get of him, you know?
We're going to take a quick break. We're going to be right back with Alan Graham.
Everybody ready? Got the tempo. Doug, at your pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
We're back with Alan Graham. You're listening to The Soul Kitchen exclusively on bbsradio.com. Alan, I've got to ask you, first of all, I'm a big car nut, and I know that Jim had a Mustang Shelby, 67 GT500, that he used to call the Blue Lady, and that's the car that's in the movie Highway, and you actually drove it.
Yeah, I'll tell you a story.
Tell us.
If you knew Jim Morrison and you've been in that car, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And a few of his friends were with him. This was the pattern every time. He had more 502s than Benihana had knives. Let's put it that way. And back then, you could get a 502 and pay $500, as many as you wanted, as long as you paid the $500. That's the way it was. That was the law. There was no driving school, none of that crap. So he was always getting busted for drunk driving. And so one day we're in Hollywood, and he says to me, come on, let's go for a ride in my Mustang. And that's what he loved to do. He punched the button, Rocky Raccoon came on. Rocky Raccoon. And he started doing this cool contrapuntal beat to Rocky Raccoon. Yeah, come on, Rocky. And so he was doing his whole thing. And he said, you like those? And I said, yeah, but I like this. And it, light my fire. And he turned it off. Anyway, so we pull up this liquor store. He buys all this country club malt liquor. Oof. Rot gut beer. No, good, but knock you on your ass. Buys all this beer. Buys some ice cream. Pamela and my wife, his sister, and my grands, and my son were waiting at the house for him up on Verbena. So he says, well, we're going to go rock and roll a bit. So we went to a few clubs. We went to the Whiskey. We met, saw Taj Mahal and a few people like that. And of course, they just let him in, you know. It's Jim Morrison. He's coming in with his brother-in-law. Oh, God, yeah. It was, like, so cool. You know, carte blanche, right? So he says, look, you're drunk, so you better drive. So he gives me the car. I've never been in one of these. You know, they're like a Corvette. They're like the ass will swivel on you. You know what I'm talking about. It's got a monster engine in a little car, and the wheels just spin. I get in the car on Sunset Boulevard near Gower. And he says, go and drive off. And I took off, and I, you know, a little lead-footed. The wheels spun, and I started doing donuts. I swear to God, in and out of cars like that. I never said a word, neither did he. When it comes to a halt, he said, I think I better drive. He gets in the car, we're going home to take the ice cream to the family, right? We get on Verbena Drive. I mean, we get on Gower. And he decides to open it up. There's no... You know, it's like dark and it's raining. And it's that first rain, you know, with the oil that makes it slick. He took off. I swear to God, it was warp speed. You know what those cars will do, right?
Oh, yeah.
From a standing still, my jaws were stuck in the back of the like that. But it was so exhilarating. And he looked so, you know, into it because he knows his car, I guess. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, the ass end of it swerved and turned into the parked cars. And we totaled 10 in a row. Boom, 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 boom. Sorry. I mean, we smashed the hell out. When I got out, we pulled over. Actually, we had no choice. The ass end of the Mustang was bent, hanging off. We could smell gas. We got out and took a look back at what we did. It looked like the cars were like a foot narrower. I mean, it was such force, you know. And all the people started coming out. What the hell went on here? So we got beer in the car. We know the cops are going to come because we've nuked all these cars. And all these people are coming. Oh, my God, what's going on here? And so I said to him, you go down there, take everybody that way, and I'll get the beer. I'll throw it in the bushes. He started saying, when I was not back there in seminary, he was doing bullshit to these people, and they were looking at him. So he started walking like the Pied Piper. Oh, let's go back down and look at your car because I think it's narrower than what we saw. So I got all the beer out and a PD. LAPD, Hollywood PD, special kind of tyranny these bastards had back then. They were tough and no bullshit cops. They saw Morrison. Soon as they saw him, they said, you sit in the car. We know who you are. But sit. And he kept saying, well, officer, they said, we just sit. Go get in the car. He said to me, what's happening here? And Morrison yells out, well, he was driving. So I didn't say anything. I acquiesced. So he said to the cop said to me, what kind of car is this? And I said, well, it's a, he started saying, it's a Shelby G. And the cop said, hey, look, it's a Mustang. That a Mustang. Morrison kept trying to say, no, it's this special. He said, oh, it's a Mustang. The cop was pissed at him, sat in the car. So Morrison says to all the people who gather around the car now, well, look, my brother-in-law's from England, and he's not used to driving on this side of the road, so it's his fault. And they all looked at me like they want to kill me. And so next morning we walked down to the gas station and we dragged the car in there. But I thought I would never survive that car. But he got it fixed back, and it was a few weeks he was back on the road again. Then it went missing. I said, where's that Mustang? And he said, you know, I was at the airport. And I was doing a gig in Chicago, and I left it at the airport, and somebody stole it. And that was the last we heard of it. What I figured was Babe Hill and a few of his cronies realized that car was totaled, and they were going to steal it for the insurance or the parts, because it never surfaced again. And I have this feeling that it's somewhere sitting in the garage waiting for us to fix it back up again.
Oh, and let me ask you, you know, you knew Jim so well, and your background with his family and his brother and his sister and his parents.
Well, just let me just say this. I'm the black sheep of the family, so you know. I'm the one who went, you know, off and did a rock opera and done all these crazy projects. So I'm kind of, you know, the black sheep. Let's just leave it at that.
All right. Well, what I wanted to ask you was, you know, obviously you saw the Oliver Stone film. And, you know, it was such a wasted opportunity. But when the truth is so readily available, why is it that you think
I'll tell you a little story about this. Oliver Stone went to see the Admiral, and he went to see the Admiral because he wanted to know about his son. So, but what he went to the Admiral with is, who is this Lizard King? Admiral knew nothing about the Lizard King, but he did know about his own son. So Oliver went away and said to the press, you know, I interviewed the Admiral. He didn't seem to understand a bit. Well, what the Admiral didn't understand was the Lizard King. And Oliver Stone didn't understand Jim Morrison either, you see. So they were both on the same page but missing each other. So the Admiral couldn't understand. In fact, he didn't want to understand. He tried to describe it like those guys who flew into the battle, you know, the recklessness. And they did their own thing, just like he flew with those guys, you know, in World War II. And he considered Jim like that. But there was a little more to it than that.
How is the Admiral?
He's a sprightly old man. He's getting on there. He's very, you know, old, 89 or something. I saw him a few months ago, and I said, hey, Admiral, how's it going? And he said, fine. Andy wheeled him by in a wheelchair to see me, so he came by my house. So I had this organ, a Casio. I said, hey, Admiral, why don't you play? You get a line, I get a pole. And he said, well, I got arthritis now, Alan. I said, well, show me a couple of chords. And he plunked that old Casio, and he... dunk, 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 and we were laughing and joking, and Andy walked away with him and said, well, bye, Admiral. He said, well, bye. And he got down the street, and he said, who was that guy? Didn't even know who I was anymore. So, but, you know, they live around the corner from me, and we've been in the same town for 40 years. I went away for a little while, but it's like I see the Admiral, and I see Andy, and I used to see Claire all the time. It's like my neighbors, you know, and it's like,
and Jim's mom just recently passed away.
Yeah, last year. Yeah. Very sad.
Well, I'll tell you what. We've got a lot of people that would like to talk to you. We've got some phone calls. But let's take a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll start taking some calls.
Right.
And there's something that I want to play here, and this also is off of Perception. Have you ever seen in the newspaper where they have the two pictures for the kids, but where they have the two pictures, and you're just supposed to tell what the difference is between the two?
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to play this. Tell me what the difference is between the two. There we go.
That version before.
You haven't.
That's cool. What's that?
It's a little bit busier bass line. There's also at the end is a very extended solo, it's Curtis
kinda,
Amy.
It's kind of punky in a weird way.
Yeah, it's great.
Morrison was the first punk, by the way. Everything came after him. Sid Vicious, they all took it from Morrison.
What do you say we take some calls?
Now, I'd just like to make an announcement, if I can, right
Please.
Now. I'd like all the Doors fans who are listening all over the world to know this. There is a scam artist out there by the name of Cliff White and his mother Lenny, and there are a gang of grifters who have been looting the grave of Jim Morrison by telling them that Cliff is Jim's son. They've taken many investors, lots of musicians, lots of people have lost their life savings over these bastards. And I want everyone to know that Cliff White is a liar and a fraud, and his mother is a scam artist, and every single person connected with them is scamming the public. So if you see a concert for Cliff pretending to be Jim Morrison, it's a scam. Don't waste your money. And, well, that's all I have to say for now, except to say that we've written the whole gang of them into one of my projects, which is Ghost Radio, where a gang of grifters loots a rock star's life. And it's a very real story, but it's based on the truth about this. So anyway, Cliff White is not Jim Morrison's son.
Let's talk about some of your projects in a minute, but first let's take this call. Hello, you're on the air. You're on the Soul Kitchen. As soon as I can get this to stop playing. All right, you're on the air.
Yes,
you have
Alan,
a question for
doing?
Alan.
I'm a big fan. How you doing, man?
Big. Who's this?
This is Jason from Arizona. I read your book and ordered offline when I first heard about it, and I saw the rock opera you did years ago. Oh. I'm just so honored to speak to you. Sorry, I'm nervous.
It's my pleasure, my friend.
Well, I have a question for you.
Yes, sir.
You know, I've been listening to you for the last hour, and my question is, what was your reaction when Jim passed? I mean, there's a lot of stuff in the
pissed
in the,
off, man.
Press.
Pissed
what?
Off, raging, pissed off, angry, yeah.
Because I was thinking he died. You know, there's so much.
Wait a minute. Let me correct you with something there.
Uh huh.
He didn't die. As far as I'm concerned, it was very, very suspicious how he died. He didn't die.
Right. Well, he. Well, the thing was. Well, I was thinking because I'm big music fan. You know, Doors, and I read Gary Patterson's book. It's amazing to me that Jim supposedly OD'd in a bathtub. And you're right, it is suspicious. And then Pamela Corson, from accounts that I've read, she died the same way. Same with Althea Flint. And Domino Harvey. I mean, that's just freaking crazy.
Well, no, it's a weird coincidence because I worked with every one of those people. Althea Flint,
oh, wow.
Domino Harvey.
I knew you had, I knew I read somewhere you worked with Larry, but I can't remember exactly what.
Yeah, I was his press secretary when he ran for president in 1983. But get to some Doors stuff.
Do you have a specific question for Alan? Because we do have other callers.
Yes. My specific thing is... when exactly are you doing the Coast to Coast, and are you going to be doing book tours?
I'll be doing book tours starting next month. But there won't be book tours. I'll be taking a good band with me. So we're doing universities, and it's not just a few hundred people in the bookstore. We're doing like big gigs, promoting the book, promoting the band, and redoing all the music. By the way, we're going to be redoing all the Doors music, and we're putting a big Doors band together.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for your time, and I'll let everybody else get on.
Thank you. Thanks for calling in. Alan, you said you were mentioning some of the other projects. Do you?
Yeah, Ghost Radio is my baby. I got two very close friends, Jesse Shakespeare in New Mexico, and he's my partner, and Scott Graves. He's the voice of Ghost Radio, Mr. Mojo, and we've never met each other, and we've created Ghost Radio in the air, and a wonderful relationship, and. Ghost Radio, you can go to my site and take a look at it, or you can actually go to darkriders.com and look at the top of all of the little buttons there. You'll see Ghost Radio, and you'll see lots of other stuff. But if you want to hear Ghost Radio in its essence, there's some sound bites there. You're going to love it.
Let's take another call. Well, I guess we lost him. Now, Ghost Radio...
It's a fictional series based on the true events of my life. The last 40 years of all of the people that I've interacted with. But it's, the main premise of Ghost Radio is that everyone, similar to Close Encounters, is on its on his way or her way to this tiny little desert radio station that really doesn't exist. It's a ghost radio station. And as in Close Encounters, when everyone who comes to her, they have an experience, let's just put it that way. It's kind of like you're going to meet your Waterloo, or you're going to change your ways, or you're not, or something is going to happen to you very different than ever happened before. So that's the premise.
Let's take another call.
All right.
All right, caller, you're on the Soul Kitchen. Hello.
Hello.
Is that Gerald?
Hello?
That sounds like Gerald Pitts to me.
No, it's your buddy Floyd Bolcox, president of Lizard Sun Entertainment. What's
Hello,
up?
Floyd. Are you still involved in the scam with Cliff?
Well, if all the listeners will go ahead to
www. Yeah, yeah, I know that. They're already there. It's a bunch of
and
crap, and you know it.
Proof is under the pudding.
Have you got
then
what?
Everybody will know who you are.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks
no,
for,
leave,
thanks
no,
for
leave
calling.
Him on, man. We should leave him
no,
on.
No, let's go ahead. You
okay.
Talk first, Al.
Okay.
You go first.
You and your scam artists know exactly what you're doing. You're trying to take charities. You're trying to take anyone who will buy a ticket for this scam bastard. And you know he's a liar. In fact, if anybody wants to know the truth, don't listen to me. Go to Hesperia. Cliff has a half-brother there who will tell you that Cliff and his mother made the whole thing up. He's a liar. He mimics Jim Good. He took me in because I was the first one to do it. And he took you in. He got you for 50 grand or so you say, and you now, even though you're faced with the reality that he's a phony, you've got so much money into it, you're like the little monkey who's got his hand in a coconut and won't let go because you think you're going to make some money. You'll never make some money off this fraud because he will never play another gig in this world as long as I'm kicking. You got that?
Well, let me know when I can talk. I don't want
well,
to interrupt
yeah, actually,
you.
Let we're,
me know when I can talk.
Actually, we're done. If you've got anything to say, put it on that shitty website you've got. Now, we're done with you. Goodbye.
Let's take another call. Oh. You're on the air, caller. Go ahead. Hello.
Yeah, I was kind of wondering what kind of music Jim and Al listened to when they were riding around together.
One time...
That's a good question.
Yeah, one time, as I say, it was... We were riding down Sunset Boulevard, and he had this monstrous sign. It wasn't the Doors. It was just Jim Morrison's face standing there with a new album. And whatever was on that top 40, that's what Morrison loved to jump between stations. I think we had three or four or five of them, and he would jump. And if we didn't like that song, we'd jump to here. And Morrison was pissed because they only played, you know, the same old crap over and over again. But it was really good because everything that current came on, he would like for instance, Rocky Raccoon, when McCartney would be singing, and he would be doing a cool contrapuntal beat like, yeah, Rocky, come on, Rocky. It was very cool, the whole thing.
Thanks for the call. Let's take another call. You're on the Soul Kitchen with Alan Graham. Evan Marshall, go ahead.
Evan, how are you doing?
Yeah, who's this?
My name's Andrew. Just been listening along here, and I got this crazy story, man. I used to be an engineer at this studio in San Diego, and the owner of the studio, he's a little whacked out. He tells me this story. When he was 6 years old, he was brought into the Capitol Studios, and he recorded, not knowing that he was going to be on, you know, not knowing it was for the Doors, but he's telling me that he was the voice of Jim Morrison. What they did, they slowed the tape down and made him basically sound older, and he was telling me this like seriously.
Well, do you have that's a great story, but do you have a question for Alan, because we got limited time?
No, just wanted to pass that along, but no worries, man. I'll keep listening next week for sure, and as you
thanks
you
very know, much
spread
okay.
the word too, brother.
Thank you.
All right, let's take another call. You're on the air. Hello. Hey, you're on the air with the Soul Kitchen.
Hey, I got cut off. I didn't get to finish my
no,
debut with
who's this?
Uncle Al.
Who is this, Floyd?
Yeah, it's me again. You guys
listen,
cut me off.
No,
I was
what we did,
polite
no,
to let
Floyd,
you talk first.
What we did, Floyd, was we cut off a redneck scammer like you. So it cut me off again.
He's gone. Floyd, you can get your own show and go on, you know, 7 days a week, 24
Come down
hours
to this station,
like.
Man. The guy here, Sam, will put you on the air. It's cool. He's a cool guy. In fact, you could be a guest on my show, Floyd, and you could bring Lenny and Cliff and all the rest of the scammers, and we could do like a, you know, a cluster, you know what I mean?
Let's talk about some good stuff. You're going to go on a major book tour?
Yeah,
to
but,
promote the
but
book.
I want to say this on the air. I'm going to take a show on this radio station. I'm going to start in a couple of weeks with Sam here. And I'm going to be doing wall-to-wall, balls-to-the-wall stuff with people like Botox there. His name is Botox, but I call him Botox. But these are the people who make you know the show because they're like animated.
You want to take another call?
Yeah.
Okay.
I hope it's Floyd again. I can tell him to F off.
You're on the air with the Soul Kitchen.
Is that you, Floyd?
You know what I mean.
Who's
Hi, you're on the air with the Soul Kitchen. Go ahead. Hello?
Can I ask a question?
Of course. You have a question for Alan?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I just want to ask, I know for sure that he killed Jim Morrison. How can he deny it?
Who's this, Anna?
No, this is just Miguel from Sweden.
Okay, so let me ask you a question. Are you telling me that I killed Jim Morrison?
Well, I'm just asking, did you kill Jim Morrison?
What did you say?
I'm not sure. I understand.
I'm not sure what your question was. Can you say it again slowly?
Oh, I'm just asking, did you kill Jim Morrison?
Did I kill him?
Are you asking if Alan killed him?
He's not dead.
Well, okay. I read online there are so many online sites right now, you know.
Yeah.
I was just wondering and, I just wanted to ask you, that's all.
No, I did not kill him. He tried to kill me a bunch of times, tried to kill me in a car. And actually, his mother tried to kill me with a car once. No, I was just joking. I wrote a story where Jim's mom came after me in a car. I called her Salamander Mama.
Let's take another call. You're on the air with the Soul Kitchen. Go ahead.
Hey, my question is for Alan. I'm curious about some of the family photos that came out in the recent books, like the Doors Coffee Table book and in the museum exhibit. Is there any plans to show some of Jim's family pictures and just get a sense of what he was like as
an
adolescent?
You'll see some never before seen in my book. But what's exciting about what's going to happen with the Doors and Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin is that they're all going to merge and they're going to be in an exhibit that's going to travel the world. So that's going to be cool. You're going to see a lot of stuff you haven't seen before in the books.
You know what? I could talk to you for another couple hours, but we're just about out of time. Would you come back on the show again?
You bet you're. I'd love to, man. It's been a blast.
Your book is called I Remember. Where can people get it again?
Go to darkriders.com. Riders with a Y.
Alan, thanks very much for being on the show
tonight.
It's
been my pleasure, Evan. Rock on, son. This is going to be a rock and roll show, man. I promise you that.
We'll see you next week, same time, right here, exclusively on bbstalkradio.com.
That was good, man.
Said it's time to close now. I guess I better go now. I really like to stay here all night. The cars crawl past, all stuffed with eyes. Lights share their hollow glow. Your brain seems bruised with numb surprise. Still one place to go.
clock says it's time to close.